Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Circle Sanctuary Network Podcasts, brought to you by Circle Sanctuary, one of the oldest nature spirituality churches in the United States, connecting people of nature-centered paths around the world. Join us through the week for a variety of shows discussing various topics, celebrating the divine in all of its forms through nature worship, rituals, education, and building bridges of community.
And welcome to Circle Talk on the Circle Sanctuary Network Podcasts. Circle Talk is hosted by Circle Sanctuary Minister Deborah Rose on the first and third Tuesdays of every month. Join her for discussions and conversations with a variety of people within the pagan community. Tonight's Circle Talk is an encore presentation from 2017, where Christopher Penzack joined Jeanette and David Ewing for a discussion on his books and his experiences with Pagan Spirit Gathering.
Okay. Hello.
Good evening.
So, David, is Jeanette here? I thought I'd ring a bell as a transition because I read the little thing and then we have that. Every other week it's Deb, so it's easy to tell. Like, okay, show started because Deb is talking now and somebody else is talking. And then so for this one, I tried to ring a bell or something. Now we came up with this idea. We need a bell or something to say, okay, that's done, show starting. So our show starts. Welcome, everybody. It's summertime. It feels like summer, at least. Our summer solstice is coming around the corner. It's just like next week.
Yeah, today's the 13th, so...
It'll be...
Next Tuesday? Next Wednesday?
Yeah.
Is the actual...
It's coming up on us, and for many of us, here on the East Coast at least, we're in Northern Virginia, and it actually felt like summer today. And yesterday, today, and I think tomorrow is supposed to break, but... We're breaking records today in the area in the 90s.
Yes, it's been warm. I guess you could say appropriately summer-like,
right.
Although that can be, it can vary quite a bit with the weather. So.
Right.
Yeah, so it's been in the 90s here. I know it's been warm on the East Coast as well, and... As we get further on into the days of summer, it'll get warmer. You have more of an occasion to have those summer thunderstorms that come through in the evening. Although, as David mentioned just a few minutes ago, south of the equator,
winter
is almost upon people in the southern hemisphere. Now, some places like Australia might not have weather that is very winter-like.
As extreme,
but they do have wet seasons and rainy seasons.
Oh, yeah.
And other places south of the equator, like places in the farther reaches of South America,
and places like that. Stuff where it actually gets wintery, yeah.
Yeah.
So, happy winter solstice to our friends and listeners and everybody on the southern hemisphere. We're thinking of you as we sit here with wish we were with you at some point in time during the course of this coming summer, I'm sure. So we've got we've been doing a series the past couple months really about Pagan Spirit Gathering. We've been talking about to presenters, musicians, workshop leaders, ministers who will be presenting at the Leadership Institute in preparation for Pagan Spirit Gathering. And we're taking a break tonight from that series of things to welcome a very special guest, somebody we've been very eager to have join us on the show, and it took some arranging because schedules are schedules as they are. But this evening we get to welcome Christopher Penzack. And I think it's his first time on Circle Talk with us, at least, and we're really happy to have him on. And if you don't know who he is, you're really missing out. He's been around for quite a while, not a long time, but he's been around, and he's been very...
Over 20 years.
Over 20 years, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, my God. That means we're getting old, too. So he's got a lot of books out, a lot of literature out. He's been doing. He's been leading a group up in his area. He's got the Temple of Witchcraft. It's been around for a while. He's been doing prison ministry stuff, community leadership stuff, teachings, the term is diverse. We won't say overtaxed or overworked. We'll say he's diverse. So let's welcome Chris on here. Christopher, good evening.
Hello, good evening. How are you guys doing?
Thanks. So is that a way to put it? You're diversified?
I'm diversified, I guess so, yeah. You got fingers in many pies, you could say.
There you go. Yeah, going through everything on your website at ChristopherPenzac.com, and it's, you know, good site. I like it, and it's got a lot of stuff there.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Yeah, actually, it's good that you mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
You're with a different publisher now, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Sure.
But it allows you to be able to write the kind of things that you are the most interested in the manner that you are most interested in, and
more freedom.
More freedom. And I'm looking through the list here, and we don't have all of your books, but we do have a number of your books.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think back on,
yeah,
like, when and where. Maybe we did hear more about your books. No, we'd already heard about your books when we first met you. We're going to back up a little bit. We first met you in person at the Pagan Spirit Gathering back in 2007 when it was still at the Wisteria Campground in southeastern Ohio. But we had already heard about you because, in fact,
we had some books already.
Yeah, we had some books, and you signed.
Signed for us, yeah.
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 So there's one right here. I think
awesome.
At the time. I know, that was a long time ago. So
those were Inner Temple.
It must have been.
Yeah.
Maybe it was only the Inner Temple.
Yeah.
And that was, although we already knew about some of the other books, and we've got many of these,
mm-hmm,
not all of them, but a decent little chunk here, and we'd heard about you,
mm-hmm,
for a while already, and we're very interested in the book. And one of the things that really interested me about the series of books that you had started writing,
the Temple series, yeah,
the Temple of Witchcraft series, was the fact that the information is presented in such a way that it allows the person going through the books to do exercises, to have homework. Several of the books have CD companions,
mm-hmm, yeah,
which are quite useful.
Yeah.
And to this day, we talk about when we've have used some of the stuff from some of your books, the CDs anyway,
mm-hmm,
as guided meditations, guided journeys. And we've kept people in advance to be forewarned because you have a really good meditative voice.
Right.
And
thank you.
You really do. And
And you did the CDs.
Yeah.
And it was very, very well done. And then you know, what I thought was interesting was that this is the first time that I'd seen books that had meditations where there was a companion CD that you could listen to in the author's voice. And it wasn't a matter of, well, here's the meditation. Read it yourself into a cassette player and play it back for yourself. And, you know, most people are very uncomfortable with that idea. So what,
absolutely,
I guess the question is, what was the impetus, what was the catalyst for the idea of including these companion CDs in the books that you created?
Well, all the books were actually class notes to start out. So before, I think Inner Temple probably came out in 2002 or so. And I'd been teaching classes on it since maybe 97. So, you know, the class notes started as like 20-page packets, and they go to 50-page packets, and suddenly you're like, I should write a book on this. And that became like the textbook for it. And the biggest experience, because a lot of what I do is very inner visionary kind of based, sensing energy, sensing spirits, kind of traveling and journeying, whether it be guided meditation or just guided sensing. And a lot of people, you know, would make the same remarks of like, oh, I read this book, but I didn't do any exercises in it because, you know, I didn't know how to do it, or it seemed really complicated. I don't like the sound of my voice. I'm not recorded, and I got nobody to do it with me who will read it to me. And there's really an art to it. You know, I feel like one of my gifts, you know, some people are incredibly psychic and some people are really, you know, very powerful to manifest things. I feel like one of my gifts as a witch is to open the way for people. So sometimes when I guide somebody through a meditation, they can do it really easily, both through the technique and the skill of modulating your voice and modulating your pace and setting the tone with appropriate music and really making sure the person's in a trance state before you get too deep. And so we have a countdown and count up technique to kind of begin and end it. And I found people could go really deep when I was guiding them, and then they could do it on their own better because they'd already been to that psychic space. So I figured when I've heard so many complaints about people not being able to actually do the meditations and exercises in a book, it would be great to put CDs together. And actually, so before I ever had any of the books out, I actually had CDs for my students. So we do the meditations in classes, and my background and my degree is in music, and I have a lot of friends that are recording engineers and musicians. So it started out with little cassettes, and then the cassettes were able to transfer to digital files, and they became CDs, and they're a bit shorter than what we have now. And then when I was signed with Llewellyn, they were very anxious to get me. I started with Wiser and played a little bit of a strange bidding war that started my writing career. And some books that Llewellyn wanted actually ended up going to Wiser. And so I ended up having a really great conversation with the owner of Llewellyn, Carl Weschke. And he said, you know, when you have another book, submit it to me, and, you know, I really want to take a first look at it. And strangely enough, Wiser rejected my next book, which was Inner Temple, and I sent it to Llewellyn, and I said, if we're going to do this, I'd really like to do, it's a 5-book series, although it turned into a 6-book, because I split 2 volumes, and I really want to do CDs with it. Do you think that's a possibility? And they were really open to working with that, and they were really supportive of the whole Temple series, and they pretty much let me put out, I think it was pretty unheard of, because they're 4, 5, and 6 CD sets that they put together, and they gave me the resources to record it really well and promoted it and kept them in print. Right now, the fourth one, the Temple of High Witchcraft, is out of print, so if you can find them, they're kind of scarce. But for the most part, they've been really supportive of the books and the CDs and what my mission was with it. So I've been very thankful about it, and I've gotten so much great feedback from people that they were actually using it. They're using it with their covens, they're using it rituals, they're using it on their own. But I'm really glad that we went to it, because it was a lot of trouble to record them. It was difficult, but it was really worth it.
That's cool. Yeah, well, we've done that with a group of folks within our that we meet up with. We first started getting together. We decided to go through the Inner Temple, Outer Temple.
Oh, the Shamanic Temple.
And the Shamanic books, with the first three as a group, and,
right.
And did it as a group class kind of a thing with the homework and the assignments and all that. And we used the CDs for the journey work and stuff, and that's
We really
benefited from that because
yeah.
Because they are written as a class notes, as a course, you know.
Right.
Yeah,
so.
And there's some linear
yeah.
thought processes that go on with, that was clear to me with the way the books were written
mm-hmm.
in a progressive manner. Also with the Inner Temple of Witchcraft, you start off people on a very basic level, which I think is really important.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't know how to work with and manipulate energy, then all the other stuff that comes after
right.
can
right.
be difficult for people to do and to conceptualize.
Yeah. Well, I started as a skeptic, and I was coming from Roman Catholicism. And so for me, it was very I needed to understand why. I needed to have a direct experience. And I couldn't just do empty ritual. And a few of the first rituals I went to with my earliest teachers, they were neat to look at, but I didn't really feel a whole lot because nobody trained me on what to feel or what to sense or how to visualize. Or, you know, I remember really clearly I went to a ritual where we called them the archangels for the four quarters, and someone who's a lot more sensitive to their energies was just like, wow, Archangel Michael was so amazing. Couldn't you feel his fiery presence? And I was like, yeah, I could hear you call him, but, you know, I didn't really feel anything. And I liked the art of the ritual, but I really wanted to have an experience. And so I was lucky that some later teachers really focused on the inner experience and the vision and the sensing and the kind of psychic work. And that's really what I emphasize, because I think a lot of people who come to me for classes were skeptics too. Like, they really wanted to learn something, but they also are like, we're modern people. Like, you know, some of this seems a little far-fetched. And today I love the romance of it, and I love grimoires, and I love all the kind of gothic-y things that can go with it. But when I started out, I really needed to know, like, why as a modern person should I be doing this? And I'll do it, but tell me why. And a lot of witchcraft books would just be like, this is the way to do it. Just do it this way. And there'd be no explanation. There'd be no theory. And there'd be no direct experience. Just do the ritual as written. So I needed something more than that, and I tried to put that in the books.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's, like I said, like we just said, we've used it for a while, and we have taught classes where we have incorporated elements
mm-hmm.
from those two books into, and we typically refer back. There's always a list of
references
and bibliography,
and we typically have the books there with us. Like, this is where we got this information. It's out of this book here. You can learn more about it. Here's the book you can get,
and
here's the CDs, and we'll use a CD, you know, one of the guided meditations off of a CD or something, a journey, rather, and people, oh, that was really great. I said, yeah, here they are. So we kind of try to help push the, you know, help do some promoting.
Right, and the
Thank
reason
you. I appreciate
why
that.
I found
yeah.
them to be useful books, and I'm not going to knock other authors necessarily because they have information on the various Sabbats and a lot of other information and
sure.
spell work and all this other stuff, but the energy work part of it from a witchcraft perspective,
mm-hmm.
I've not seen. And I still have yet to see many authors go into any in-depth detail to the extent that you did to create a whole book.
Yeah, in a series.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you're still one of the rare ones out there, even in 2017, that decided to create a book and write a book that teaches this in a way that is accessible to people. So I really hope that people, anybody who's listening now or listening later, because we have a lot of downloads on our podcast,
uh-huh.
so we have a variety of different ways
of folks
that people can
do it, later on.
Do it
yeah.
live, but yeah,
right.
a lot of people listen later on. So I highly recommend looking for that
mm-hmm.
book, and you can still find it.
Which one?
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yep.
Yeah,
so
I tried to write the books, you know, in all the books, I tried to write the books I wished I had. So, you know, all the books are a labor of love of trying to gather the information and the teachings and the experiences that I wish someone wrote a book on. So I felt like if I wished it, maybe other people wished it, and let me put together what I learned into something that will hopefully not just serve me, but help other people too.
Right. I think it's a very useful set of books. Now, one of the, and I'll just tell you the books that we have. So we have the Inner Temple and the CD.
Yeah.
We have the Outer Temple and the CD.
Shamanic.
I want to think that we bought the Witch's Shield before.
We have the Witch's Shield, and I think it did come with a CD.
It does have a CD.
Yeah.
And we've incorporated that book into a protection magic class because, again, it's got some really good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I like your visualization examples for creating shielding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into some degree of detail about the kinds of psychic harms and magical harms, I guess you could say, that people have experienced and examples of types and things like that. So it's very, again, it's a very useful book. Even if you never listen to the CD, the other information in there is quite useful. So I'm going to back up just a little bit, and you just mentioned that your first exposure to religion was not paganism, Wicca, witchcraft. You were raised, what, Roman Catholic?
I was raised Roman Catholic, yes. 12 years of Roman Catholic, you know, schooling and kindergarten even, so I guess 13 years. Yeah. So I was traditionally raised Catholic.
The sisters and the nuns and whoever it was that taught you in Catholic school, we still
it
hear about
that.
It
wasn't that bad for my generation. I'd say, like, we had mostly lay teachers, but I'd say maybe every few years you get a nun or you get a brother. I actually had one amazing nun who was my religion teacher for sophomore and junior year in high school. And she was very artsy and not what you'd think of as a nun. And she was actually the first person to propose the idea of a feminine divinity, or you could look at divinity as feminine. And she just said this offhand comment of, you know, talking to God every day. And as she's talking, she's like, yes, I pray to her every day. And we're all like, what? Like, you know, God's a man. I'm like, how can you say that? And she's like, do you really think the creator of the whole universe would be limited to just male or female? And I was like, my mind was blown. Unfortunately, she was fired the next year. So who knows where Sister Conchetta ended up. But it was really an amazing seed for me to kind of have planted and to have a nun plant it. I think a lot of nuns are a lot more liberal than people give them credit for. Not all of them, but quite a few.
Wow.
That's cool. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
Okay. Well, we also have Sons of the Goddess.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
we have Sons of the Goddess, too.
Well, we also have the
the
herbal-y one, the plant magic-y one.
Uh-huh. Oh, cool. Yep, so it sounds like you got some of my Copper Cauldron books, too. That's excellent.
I know.
Yeah.
So we have a bunch. He's kind of funny.
So
when did you first become interested? Were you already a teenager in your early 20s?
I had a really good friend of our family who was my art teacher when I was, like, from second grade to high school, was a witch. But that was back in the days where, like, it wasn't public as much. And, you know, there wasn't pagan family events. And, you know, you didn't see pagan prides the way you see them now. And she was a store owner in the local community here. So she was very hush-hush about, you know, who she was and what she was doing. But I'd known her since I was 7. And so when the time I graduated high school, she, you know, really came from the school of thought, you don't solicit to minors, you don't expose yourself to, you know, people under 18 and that type of thing. So once I hit 18, she started dropping hints, which I was clueless about. Like, but we would talk about art history, and we talk about the Celts, and we talk about the Egyptians and Greek statuary and all these things leading up paganism. And then finally she just kind of laid it on me as like, you know, I'm a witch, right? You get it. And I just thought that was hysterically funny. Like, I thought she was kidding me. Cause I really had this kind of agnostic curiosity about things, and I was exploring Eastern spirituality and yoga and Buddhism and things like that, and really hadn't found anything I could practice, but I liked the philosophies of it. And so when she introduced me to something that you could actually do, I was both intrigued, and I didn't quite think it was real. I thought she was kidding. And so once I realized she wasn't kidding, then I thought, oh, this must obviously be a cult, and you know, she must have joined something crazy. And when I realized there was no hierarchical leader that she was, you know, focused on, she had teachers and things like that, but she ran her own group, and you know, it all seemed very egalitarian for the most part, but and she invited me to a ceremony. I was like, oh, I want to know more about this, and I want to be able to speak the language with her so I can understand what she's talking about. She gave me a few books, and I read the books, and we came back, and she's the one who taught me how to meditate, and she's the one who taught me how to read cards. And okay. I never joined her coven, but we got to a point where she was like, you know, you're asking really good questions, and they're questions a little bit beyond me. And she introduced me to her teacher, who was Lori Cabot. And I started studying with Lori Cabot down in Salem, Mass. And I only studied really with her with a short time. She was set up to do very public classes. So I did all her public classes at the time. And then kind of struck out on my own and started exploring other things and other systems of healing and other systems of magic. But I really started as a skeptic, and I really started as someone who was searching, but didn't know what I was searching for, really.
And among other things, with the kinds, well, this is based on some of the books that you've written. I know Kabbalistic studies have been something that you studied with, because there's elements of that in some of your temple books, right?
Yep, absolutely. I think at heart, I'm truly one of the labels, although I wholly identify with the label witch, I truly identify with the idea of being an occultist and a seeker of the hidden and the mysteries. And the Western occult tradition is so deeply tied, whether even if you're just thinking of witchcraft, if you go beyond, you know, kind of a modern view of Wicca and get into other forms of magic and occultism and witchcraft, it's tied to theosophy, and it's tied to alchemy, and it's tied to Rosicrucian and spiritualism, and it's tied to Kabbalah. And Kabbalah is a really great way of organizing all these ideas. And I start to realize that a lot of the founders of modern Wicca were also ceremonial magicians, and they also had this knowledge. And if you read a lot of folklore and tradcraft stuff, you realize that a lot of the underpinnings there, whether they say it explicitly or not, are very Kabbalistic. And so I just wanted to know more, and you know, I started studying on my own ceremonial magic. I didn't actually join a lodge or a formal tradition of it, but starting out with books like Donald Michael Craig's Modern Magic and looking into self-initiation of the Golden Dawn, and that led me to Aleister Crowley. You know, I really just wanted to know everything I could about magic and you know, why people were into these rituals, and realizing so many traditions altered them to fit their own mythos and to fit their own worldview, I started to alter them to fit mine. And part of the classes I teach on Kabbalah now are learn the original rituals, but then as you feel comfortable with them, alter them to fit your own mythos, alter them to fit your own worldview, as long as they fulfill the same function. Part of the art of witchcraft versus the science, the function, and the art is, you know, how does it speak to your soul? So, you know, if you don't want to do it because Golden Dawn style Kabbalah is very Judeo-Christian in a lot of ways, even though it's very pagan too, if that doesn't suit you, you know, what kind of imagery do? You can look at Aleister Crowley's work and find he reconstructed everything to fit his thelemic scheme, which is more goddess-oriented, is more kind of sex-oriented. And, you know, if that suits you, then, you know, figure out what are the mythologies speak to you and rewrite the rituals in those ways. So it's kind of a challenge to a lot of my students to not just accept what came before, but to kind of forge new ways.
I do know that in your books, you've been very careful to write that this is one way that you do it, but I forget the type of exact phrasing that you've used in the books, but you've said in the books that this is something you don't have to do, or you don't have to look at it this way, that this is one way of looking at it and one way
right.
of doing something.
Well, it's like
not
describing your inner temple.
Right.
It can be, you know, when you take the journey and you enter the space that is your inner temple, it is how you wish it to be. It doesn't have to be any way in particular.
Right. Yeah, I'm a big believer we have to be on guard for dogma. And we have to be on guard, even though we may take patterns we've experienced as teachers and try to present those patterns to students, we also have to make sure we don't try to present our experiences as the truth. You know, so it's very easy to say, oh, my inner temple is a pyramid, so everybody's inner temple should be a pyramid, and this is what the pyramid looks like. Well, if I figured that out on my own, then you should give students the freedom to figure out what it is for them on their own. I think that's where we sometimes go off the rails, is we think our experience is the experience. So for me, witchcraft, although I believe it's a religion and it's an art and it's a science, it's also a series of techniques. You know, sometimes people talk about our temple of witchcraft community that grew out of the teachings and grew out of the books and grew out of the classes. And, you know, people be like, oh, well, what's your theology and what's the way, you know, your tradition does things? And we have some kind of standard patterns, but we definitely, you know, encourage people to play with them, and we encourage people to use the techniques. So the thing that joins us all together is this pattern of techniques, not necessarily it having to be one way. And in the end, I mean, I don't think I'm particularly enlightened, so I'm just trying to share things with people that have been helpful for me. If they're helpful for you, that's great. If they're helpful that they inspire a different idea, then that's great. I'm happy to be the inspiration or partial inspiration for that. I read a lot of books, and I might not agree with anything or, you know, some of the things in the book, but it'll inspire me to be like, oh, I think of it as this way. Let me try that. And, you know, as long as it takes you further in your path, whatever it is, I think the book or the teaching has done a service.
So we're talking about the teaching. So you do a lot of teaching through the books, and of course, a lot of people get a lot of long-distance kind of non-contact teaching through the books that you've
right.
written, and you've been a very prolific author. There's a lot out there that you have, and a lot of variety of things and stuff, and it all has a certain base, but, you know, it's a good variety that comes together.
Mm-hmm.
But you also do work, community-related stuff, there in your local area. So can you talk a little bit about what you do locally?
Sure. Well, you know, I do work locally, and I also travel pretty extensively. So I'd say my main job, I mean, I happen to be an author, but my main job is a teacher. So I both do local classes and workshops and intensives all over the country, and some stuff in Europe and some stuff in South America. Because I really believe all the books are great and online, and we do some online classes as well through our Temple of Witchcraft. I think nothing really beats the in-person experience. Nothing beats the in-person ritual. Nothing beats that kind of direct transmission of mouth to ear, you know. But on top of that, like the temple series, you know, the books kind of led to, you know, the books, the classes led to the books, but the classes kind of grew into public rituals. So we started hosting the Sabbats, and it just started with an annual Samhain, and then Samhain with Samhain and Beltane, and then suddenly we're doing publicly all eight of the Sabbats. And then that led to community kind of looking for something. And it was interesting because a lot of the people were kind of struggling for, well, what are we? We all practice these things together. And I was very anti-tradition. I was very kind of, like I said, I'm anti-dogma, so I was very anti-tradition in a lot of ways, probably a little too much so. And people were going through and calling themselves all sorts of strange names, trying to identify themselves in comparison to, let's say, Gardnerian Wicca or Alexandrian Wicca. So, like, some people running around here saying they're Penzacian Wicca or Christopherian Wicca. And I was like, oh, no, we don't, like, there's nothing that has to be named after me. And so since the books was called the Temple of Witchcraft series, we just started calling the community the Temple of Witchcraft. And as we continued, people had shared goals of, you know, wanting to serve. And a big thing about it is not everybody is called to or cut out to lead a coven. So rather than hive off and have other people teach and be public ritual, some people want to do environmental work. Some people want to do social justice work. Some people want to do prison ministry. There's a lot of ways you can serve. Some people want to do one-on-one counseling or bereavement support or, you know, men's mysteries or women's mysteries. And so we created a structure based on the zodiac. So there's 12 ministries for the 12 signs, and each ministry has its own area of expertise. And as you go through the classes, you can volunteer, but you don't have to. And we set up in-person and online education. So we've got members all across the world at this point. One of the big things, you know, we were talking about before the shop a little bit, before the show a little bit, was our prison ministry. So today I actually spent time in the Berlin State Prison in New Hampshire, and we did a little early summer solstice ritual for the men up there. So one of my areas of focus in this area has been serving the New Hampshire State Prisons, particularly this area in Berlin. It's pretty far north of me. And I really enjoy it. And we've got some other ministers that are serving prisons in other parts of the country, particularly Utah. We service quite a lot. And it's one of the ways that we can kind of give back to community. And I'm a big believer that witchcraft is often for those who are on the outcasts and the edges and the marginalized. And so one of our mythologies or teachings is that as witches, we have to reach out and minister to those people on the edge that won't be caught by other mechanisms in society or mainstream churches or mainstream social services. And so many people, particularly pagans in prisons, are just forgotten. You know, like a lot of pagans don't realize there's pagans in prisons, and a lot have the attitude of, well, like, why bother? They're criminals. And really the only religious support they have in these institutions are usually Christian. There's a little bit of Jewish. There's a little bit of Islam. There's a little bit of Buddhism, but mostly they're Christian. And so for the guys who identify as Wiccan, heathen, Asatru, Druids, they don't really have a lot of support. And so being able to reach out even in these small ways, I'd love to be able to help more of them, but just you got to act locally. So this is the prison that's near me. So this is the prison I service. But it's been really rewarding, and we've had a wonderful time with it.
Nice, and it's good to get out that there are pagans in prison who do need support and service.
Yeah.
People don't really think about it. I mean, I think it's easier for folks to just not think about that.
Right.
You know, we do a lot
of
work.
It's a hard industry. It's not for everybody, yeah. But it's definitely worth it.
Oh, definitely. You know, we're associated with Circle Sanctuary, and Circle does prison ministry. There are some Circle ministers who go into prisons and do work in the ministries in the prisons. And they've talked about
what it's
about and how when it's done well is very appreciated and very, very useful. But like you said, it's not easy either, because you have to I'm not sure about the facility that you go into, but one of the other folks we talked to said he has to send him a list of everything he's going to bring in and why everything. He said it was down to the point where he came into the prison one time. And he said he'd listed that he had a pentacle pendant, and they said, okay, you can take the pendant, but you have to leave the cord, because it wasn't on the list. Okay, so wear the pendant, because the cord wasn't on the list of things he was bringing in. So, I mean, one of the facilities is that particular about, you list everything you're bringing. You know, if you're bringing a necklace, if you're wearing a necklace, you've got to list the cord and the pendant, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So that's the kind of stuff, and you have to be very committed to it. If you're going to, you know, you only have so much time to do things, so you have to be on time every time, and have a good relationship with the prison ministry team, working with that, because there's no pagan standard time.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, everything's very scheduled in the prison, and I will say we've been very lucky at the prison I service. The staff has been incredibly supportive. The chaplain there has been incredibly supportive. He actually requested us. We didn't know there was a need. He found us online. He requested through one of our ministers if somebody would come through. And it's a bit of a trek. Like, we're based just on the border of New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and the prison's about 3 hours away. So it's an all-day affair. It's a three-hour drive out. We go there for a Sabbath. We have a feast meal with them. We do the ritual. We take a class. And then, you know, we come home another 3 hours. So it's a pretty all-day affair for us. And it's good. And I'm happy to do it. But we've had great support. Like, I'm amazed at the things that they've approved for us. And sometimes it's staggered me. Like, they're very visceral because, you know, they don't really have a lot of stuff to do. And when they're in their cells, they don't have anything or not a lot of stuff with them. So we get to do ritual outside. We got that approved after a couple of years. We got a fire pit approved. And we get, you know, full on fire to make offerings. We've got grains and herbs approved. And we have the little pouches that we can make offerings to the spirits and the gods. We've got a little apple cider drink approved, so we can have sacrament as a part of it. Today we did the summer solstice ritual, and we're in like this little, you know, kind of meadowy area that's been mowed down, but not mowed down really well. And so there's our fire. There's lots of little wildflowers kind of growing, things people would just think of as weeds. But we did a whole plant spirit medicine meditation where I showed them what plants were what and what they were used for magically. And I asked everybody to make an offering to grab a little bit of a plant. And we used that part of our great rite sacrament with our apple drink and drank in the medicines and held the plant and then offered the plant to the fire to release the spirits and took the plant with us on a drumming journey. And the thing that's really blown me away the most is we're truly trying to craft something because there's so many disparate groups that come under pagan in the prison. So there's Wiccans, there's Kemetic Egyptians, there's Asatru and various forms of heathens and folk. There's Druids from Celtic persuasions. There's people of a Santeria or a Voodoo background that gets lumped in with pagan. There's some people straddle the line that they sometimes go to the Native American stuff. They sometimes come to the pagan stuff because it's all kind of lumped under earth religion, although if you're truly claim Native, that's a separate group. And so they all end up on our doorstep. So we had 35 guys, and we were constantly trying to craft rituals that aren't any one culture. So I know if I do it just as Wicca, you know, that dissatisfies some people. If I do it much more of a heathen type of thing, that dissatisfies some people. So we're kind of crafting our own traditions, definitely based in occultism, but try to be consistent each time rather than change it up each time so it builds up a thought form. And part of it, to give them something visceral, I asked for permission to bring in a stang, a forked staff, and to bring in a goat skull as a symbol of the god and have that be very visceral. And I was stunned to find out it got approved. So we have a goat skull hanging on a stang and planted in the ground by the north of the fire pit. And every man gets to kind of get past the stang. And when we do solar rituals, they stare at the sun through the two tines. And we pass the goat skull around and ask the blessings of the goat father and hang that from the stang. And I get to bring in a drum. And they've been incredibly supportive in ways that I'm always surprised me. You know, sometimes little things won't go over to, like, I asked for new candles. And because the candles were not on the approved list of candle manufacturers, that couldn't go through. But my goat skull got through. So it's really weird what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, and it sounds similar to the experiences some of the other circle ministers have talked about.
Yeah.
And how they have to be very mindful about crafting what we call like a pan-pagan type ritual to try to accommodate as many people as possible, to be very generalist so that people's spiritual needs are still able to be met, which can be quite
and not
challenging.
Excluding people, you know, as much as you can.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a challenge. And honestly, the way I've tackled it, which, you know, I guess wouldn't be the way most people would tackle it, is I actually went for witchier, more occult, but something that wasn't any one of those things. So they could all feel like they're belonging to something that, you know, it's different but complementary to whatever they feel their home practices or their core practices. And we actually do, after you've gone to four of the Sabbats, you can go to, I have a special kind of a consecration, kind of welcoming them in, that we like a dedication to the work that we're doing there and welcoming them to the Temple of Witchcraft. And it's fun when we're talking to the chaplain there. He's like, so this is like a baptism. I'm like, yeah, more or less it's a baptism. And he's like, so do we need a big tub of water? I'm like, nope, we don't need a tub of water. I just need some oil. Like, we're good. And he got me frankincense oil, and it went all well. So, but trying to craft an identity, like, I find myself the more kind of pan-pagan and acceptable you try to make it to everybody, I feel like the more watered down it gets and the less I get out of it. So we've made it, like, really occult, and we've made, like, there's toning to it. We've got the goat skull, and we're throwing things in the fire, and we're dancing. And it might not belong to any one tradition. I've tried to make it very primal. But I feel like guys are getting, you know, a lot out of it, the ones who can participate and feel that connection. Like, some of them, I'm sure, just join because they want to be outside with the fire and have their feet in the grass. And they're not particularly educated or interested in the intricacies of paganism or witchcraft. And that's okay, too. You know, as long as they're getting something out of it, I'm happy to serve.
Right. That's cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. You could probably, could be an idea for a new book.
Yeah, I'm actually writing a little grimoire for my men up in the Berlin prison. So, like, each Sabbath we've kind of written out with all the parts and how to do it. And there's some complex quarter calls and things, because each thing in the quarter call is a spirit that they can call upon. I'm doing these little short meditations they could do in their cells, and just, you know, basics of things that they wouldn't normally get, because they'd get it if they were immersed in the culture outside. But, like, basic ritual etiquette type stuff that just is a no-brainer for a lot of us that are on the outside, but for them, they've never been taught it, and a lot of them find paganism in prison, so they've never actually been exposed to paganism outside of prison, so they don't know how things go. Like, I really had to educate them on, like, when we're doing the rituals inside, there's a big window in the classroom space before we get to go outside. And so if their buddies would walk by, it's kind of their set culture of, like, it's not even a wave, but it's a gesture. You know, who knows exactly what it means? They could be doing gang signs, but I don't think so. But I had explained to them that it's distracting to everybody in the ritual. And when you're in the ritual, you're 100% in the ritual, and nothing outside of the ritual should matter, no matter who goes by. And they're like, oh, really? Like, I didn't get that. I didn't realize I was being disrespectful. And so it's interesting of having to educate people on that level and just kind of bring them into the culture of it if this is what they want to learn.
Well, I mean, that's similar to the kind of stuff that we still have to teach people on the outside, you know, in
sure.
Who are new,
like,
to the paint,
too, is social stuff.
Say again?
I feel like people on the outside pick up the social cues maybe a little quicker.
Well, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Most of the time.
Until you've done it in the prison, you know, I will say it's a slower rate. But it's just because they also have a strong prison culture that's alien to me.
Right.
You know, so I don't know what their social mores are and, you know, where they're coming from things and what's acceptable, what's expected of them. So it's interesting to step in, just not outer culture, but prison culture, you know, and having to be like, okay, I need you to be present here, because I think the prison culture part is very dominant. Like, it takes a long time for some of the new men to feel comfortable closing their eyes for a meditation, because they're constantly in a danger state. You know, somebody could hurt them, so they're not going to close their eyes. And I'm like, okay, nope, we're in our own private space. We're locked up. It's just us. No one's going to hurt you here. I have my eyes open. If someone's going to do something, I'll say something. Don't worry. But it's hard to get people to relax into that trust in that environment.
Yeah, I can imagine it would be.
It is.
So there are,
there
are definitely some unique challenges that come with prison ministry, from the logistics, which allow to take in, and, you know, a variety of other
and just working
things
within the culture there too,
yeah,
because it is a very different,
right,
different culture to work with, like you say. You know, well, I mean, you know, we get new people who come into virtual space and stuff. We have to, you know, tell them, you know, there's the guidelines and stuff, but most people usually you've got enough people in a circle or in a virtual space that have done it before, so just follow along and you'll be fine.
Yep.
You know, and in that environment, you've got so many people who haven't been before, there's not a whole lot of follow along.
Right.
So you do have to, that's interesting. It kind of makes you think a little more about what you're up to. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been beautiful and a challenge all at the same time.
I'll bet.
Now, I know we're already at a quarter till, so...
See, we said it happens.
I know, it always happens. So, we did spend a little bit of time talking about your books and what you've got going on. Now, do you actually have, because I seem to remember this, an actual, like, building, a place, right, where...
We do, yeah.
That?
Yep, it's the Temple of Witchcraft. Part of the shared community goals that we did was about being, you know, we're a land-based tradition that ironically doesn't have a whole lot of land in terms of paganism and witchcraft in general. And often we find ourselves, you know, constantly renting space from Masonic halls and new churches and things like that. And there's a few big things like Circle Sanctuary, you know, but there's not a lot of pagan groups that have physical, tangible space. And I think part of the, at least for me, part of the occultism is that the current that you're practicing also has to be grounded in the ground, like in the sacred space, in a place where people gather and the power gathers, and something that can also, I think, is important to be passed off to the next generation. You know, here in New England, there's a lot of people who have what we'd affectionately refer to as the witch house. You know, there'd be the person in the community that had the house where people could gather, where a coven stead that was large enough to have open Sabbaths, whether it be, you know, 10 people or 20 people over the coven, or a large party or a large gathering where, you know, be open, semi-public. And then what would happen was that, you know, that person would pass on, or that person would move, or that person, you know, would change something in their life, and that community meeting space would disappear because it was all under the roof of one private individual. You know, even though it was a coven stead, usually one person owned it. And so all these great kind of resource centers, like I think of the three places that had most of my Sabbaths kind of through my training experience, aren't available as any type of community place of gathering because people sold the house. And you know, in New England, there's always the old kind of witchy houses that some, you know, crazy elder in our community would have and invite people in. And that was part of the mystique, and that was part of the magic of it, at least for me. and, you know, meeting at some of the big public gatherings didn't quite always do it for me. You know, I like having that space where, you know, magic has been being worked all the time. And none of them, you know, outlie any one generation. Because often, you know, if the person passes on, their kids aren't into it, and the kids sell the house, and there you go. So it was really important for us to get something that could be passed on. So as we ended up incorporating in the state as a church, and then we got our nonprofit status in the federal government, so we're 501c3. And part of our goals was to raise enough money. We ended up spending 2 years renting an office just to prove we could make a mortgage payment. And then with that, we were able to get an investor who was able to give us a mortgage, and we're looking for property. And we found this really amazing Victorian house that had a house, a cottage, a barn, 5 acres, a stream, an old train track trail that's now like a horse trail, and a lot of space to be able to do things, and garden, space for gardens and such. So although we looked at many different properties, this is, you know, where we kind of settled on as a community. And so now the main house is open to the public on the downstairs area as a kind of store / business office and a teaching space / temple where you can either see private clients with our ministers, or we can teach classes up to about 20. We're in the process of making up architectural plans to the barn, and the barn will be opened up as our community center. So we'll have a dedicated ritual space. We'll be able to expand the store and community space so people can do healing work and reading works as ministers. We want to have a kind of soup kitchen, food pantry for people who might not feel comfortable going to traditional Christian resources for that, and that'd be another way to serve the community. And we have a cottage for visiting teachers and for people who want to do retreats. The cottage has all been refurbished, and now we're in the process of kind of cutting trails and trying to set up ritual spaces. So we'd like to have a big kind of stone circle. We'd like to have a couple shrines, different places and gardens for our magical herbs to grow and to share with the community. So that's been our big goal. And the upper residence of the house is where the founders of the temple live. So right now it's me and my two partners, Steve and Adam, who do a lot of the administration and running the temple. And our goal is to eventually be able to pass this on as part of the community. And because it's held by the temple, then it's something not held by a private individual. So it's something held by the community. And either the rest of the house, once we've, you know, had a chance to pay for it all, will either be a museum or a retreat house or some type of library where, you know, people can gather and research, or perhaps the people take over and leading the temple will live here after us, you know, whatever comes next in the next generation. But our goal was really to kind of create the magical witch house where people could come and gather and know that magic and help was there. And it's been funny. We've got kind of a mixed reception in town. It's actually in Salem, New Hampshire, and it's the town that I grew up in. And some people love having us here, and we're affectionately referred to as the witches on the hill, and other people who are a little, you know, less happy that we're here. But so many people just show up on the doorstep looking for help who would be hesitant to come to a witchcraft gathering. But they'll knock on their door and ask if, you know, how do they get a reading, or different people have needed kind of social service help and they felt they weren't comfortable going to a church, so we can help them through the process. But they're all kind of on the down low because they feel like they have no other place to go, but maybe the witches will help them, which is part of the beauty of the service of what we're doing. So I'm glad that we're available. It's a little scary to be that public, but it's also really beautiful to be available to those who are in need.
Right. So it's been clearly expanded outward so that you are ministering to your community, to the larger
right.
community, not just the people who've taken your classes and, you know, purchased your books and whatnot. And that
right.
is a huge undertaking. And
I deal.
It is. And I applaud you for being able to make it happen. I know that you are quite aware of how many times on different occasions you'll see different places in the United States where people will try to make it happen, and for one reason or another, it just doesn't come together. So the fact that you were able to do it at all is a feat unto itself, because
yeah.
it's a hard
Thank
thing
you.
To do.
It has been a hard thing. It's been very rewarding, but it has been a hard thing. We have amazing people. We have an amazing board of directors. Those 12 ministries we talked about, the heads of them are our council. You know, we've had just amazing people who are willing to, who hold this vision with us. It's not just my vision. You know, honestly, on a lot of levels, I would be totally happy just being an author. You know, I could just write and travel occasionally and teach. And on one level, that would really satisfy me. But I really feel like my work and working with community, and the community has had these visions and we've discussed them. And I've been able to give them focus, you know, and I've been able to kind of give them word and picture and navigate some of the legal stuff, but it's really kind of from the community up of, you know, what we want to do and sharing this. You know, I was fine just kind of teaching classes and holding public Sabbaths for as long as I did, but then people were looking for identity and people were looking for ways to serve. And, you know, I think it's really important to have those resources to help people find the ways that they're going to serve and to reach out to the rest of the community. You know, are we serving all of Salem? Absolutely not. I think most people find us a curiosity. They'll drive by and say, that's the witch house. I think half the town honestly forgot that we're here. You know, we made the newspapers when we moved in 5 years ago, but, you know, since then we've been pretty quiet. Every so often we'll have people, you know, who'll show up. But everybody's well. Bigger public Sabbaths a couple towns down. We rent a bigger hall because our Salins and Beltanes can be up to 100 people, and the space here doesn't hold that yet. Once we have the community center open and outdoor ritual spaces set, we might be able to have more of it here. But we're also at, you know, a limited level of parking. But people will show up just out of curiosity, or people will show up in need, or people will show up wanting to help in some way, even if they're not witches. And I've been really blessed for that. So I think it really developed organically, you know, rather than trying to force it. And, you know, step by step, we kind of listen to ourselves, we listen to spirit, we listen to the people who are involved, and try to move together forward. It can be daunting because there's so much to do, but we also have so much support to get it done. It's been really liberating at the same time.
Yeah, that can certainly take up some time and attention and be a big undertaking if you don't have a support crew, some people there to help you envision it and carry through the vision there. So I'm checking out the website here, looking at it, templeofwitchcraft.org. Pretty easy to find there. Temple of Witchcraft, where's the website? templeofwitchcraft.org. So, and it's like and there's pictures and stuff here. I found some photos on the maps and stuff too. It looks like a great, nice house.
We had neighbors who at first were a little fearful about, like, oh, the witches are moving in. We invited them over. We invited all the neighbors over the year we moved in to, like, a little Halloween party. And she was so funny because, like, we're 2 hours into it. We're having, you know, drinks and food and snacks and music and everything and answering people's questions and just getting to know them. And she turned to me and she's just like, so when are the witches coming? And I'm like, you're surrounded by them. And she's like, well, what do you mean? You're all very normal. I'm like, yeah, witches are normal people too. Like, you know, I think she was expecting the big hats and the, you know, the archetype of the Halloween witch. I'm like, no, we're witches. Like, we identify as witches, but, you know, it's witches are people too, as I, you know, often like to tell people. And then later on, she came up to us when things were getting settled and we had to put a parking lot in to open up and satisfy all the requirements of the town. And she came up to me outside and she goes, you know, when you look at the house, it really looks like it should be the Temple of Witchcraft. And I was like, yeah, we thought so too. That's why we bought it. She was like, I'm glad you guys got it. You know, I'm glad somebody got who loves the house got it, because it's a beautiful old Victorian house from the late 1800s. And it's sad. It's, you know, growing up in this town, I've known the house and it's good times and it's bad. It's been somewhat derelict. It's been rebuilt. You know, and so having people that really care about it and hopefully a foundation that will be able to take care of it in the future, you know, is important because it's one of the oldest houses in town. So I'm excited that she appreciated that too.
That's cool.
Yeah, nice.
Now, at the top of the hour, you talked about some of the mini books that you've written. And before the show, we talked a few minutes about the fact that you started your own publishing company. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, when we originally created the temple, we wanted to have a religious publishing company as a part of the temple. And the funny way the IRS works, I think if I wasn't well known, we probably could have done it. But because, and I quote, I had success in my genre, previous success in my genre, unquote, they said that I couldn't open a publishing company. I think they were afraid of us trying to basically hide money as a nonprofit. So we ended up opening up the publishing company as an independent business, and we're able to donate and do anthologies that fully support the temple. So we have a number of anthologies that all profits, not just royalties, but all profits beyond cost of printing and shipping and any advertisements goes directly to the temple. So it's a way that we can kind of support. And it's also a way to kind of give me some freedom, because when you're with the bigger publishers, even though, you know, metaphysical occult witchcraft publishers aren't like Simon & Schuster, but they have greater expectations of trying to make something more palatable to the largest number of people so they can sell more books. And I'm kind of at the phase where, you know, for the most part, I've written a lot of the basic books that I want to write. And I feel like if you're following my deeper work, I'm assuming you have kind of the knowledge of the temple series, at least in part, on some level. Even if you've not followed it, like, you're not looking for that because I've already written that. So I really wanted to write things about the practices that we have in the temple that are deeper. And just the business model of it, I can probably, you know, generate the same amount of income selling 1,000 books, doing it this way, than I could 10,000 books through a traditional publisher. So it's very helpful to be able to sustain the type of work that I want to do, so I don't have the pressure of having to do large numbers of books. You know, I can write things as esoterically or artistically. I put out a poetry book as a fundraiser. You know, it's very freeing to it. So, like, I recently wrote a book about three years ago, called The Mighty Dead, which is all on the kind of exalted ancestors. And looking at the book, I'm super happy with it, and I love the way it came out. I love the teachings of it. It's become a core part of what I travel and teach in the temple. But I can't see putting that out through a mainstream publisher because I just don't think it has a wide audience. It's a little bit too out there. It's a little bit too advanced. Or talking about some of the darker aspects of the poisonous plants and the plant spirit familiar. I know in some of the books I'd be like, oh, be very cautious about how you talk about this. Well, I'm going to talk about how I practice with it. I'm not going to give anything, you know, that's not factual or not how I use it, but I'm also not going to be concerned as much about making it palatable and not scary for people, you know?
Right, and that's something that we always run into, too, is, and we've kind of gotten to that point, too, is trying to find information out there from somebody who's not local, you know, any kind of books or other resources and stuff that are beyond the basic kind of stuff. You know, there's a lot of that out there, but it's like, okay, so you know, we run into that with groups and others and stuff too. It's like, okay, well, we've gotten everything we can here. What's next? You know, what more? And I'm looking at the Ancestors of the Craft. I actually drew my attention earlier during our conversation, and I see right at the beginning, it says, in the description, that the profits from the sales of the book go to support the temple, a 501c3 religious nonprofit devoted to the great work. So, you know, it's a great way to help finance and support the temple, and it gives. And I really, we've heard this from other authors too about how some of the publishers are very well. We need this many books. This is what we want you to do, and make sure this and the guidelines and requirements and everything can be really daunting and which has driven other authors away from some of the big publishers to be able to have more freedom about what they're about and what they do. And like you said, so, you know, people get when you're writing during the earlier books that came out from the other publishers, the big publishing companies and stuff, then once they get to the point where, okay, now what? You know, now you can do that. You have that freedom.
Yeah, and that's your own
seat,
too.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I've been very blessed. I'm not downplaying the support the major companies have given for me. Early in my career, both Wiser and Llewellyn at various times have been really great and really wonderful to me and very supportive of my work and, you know, giving me tour support and all that. But publishing's changed a lot too. And, you know, I made this decision before the temple really was formed. You know, either I could go the direction of, you know, fame and fortune and kind of simplifying my teachings and not focusing on the W word, so to speak, and, you know, and there's an aspect of me that's interested in all that. I like consciousness. I like, you know, healing. I like esoteric thoughts. And I could very easily have gone through something more mainstream and tried to go with a bigger publisher and trying to, you know, kind of grow my market on that level. But I don't think I would have been happy. And so, you know, I chose very specifically to go more occult, to go more into the witchcraft, to go, I won't say dark in a way that's scary, but not avoiding the things that are very shadow-based and not avoiding underworld traditions and not watering it down. And I knew that would shrink my market in some ways. Like, you know, Barnes & Noble and large companies still carry my Copper Cauldron books, but where they might order 10 of my, you know, Llewellyn books for each store, they might order one for half of their stores, my new Copper Cauldron books. But they're out there now with the internet and, you know, various forms of Amazon and direct sales through my website. People can find different books and, you know, people are much more likely to follow authors they like by signing up on their websites and their Facebooks and their Twitters. And there's just different ways to reach people and still have that market and that base. So I don't have to sell 10,000 books of something that I might not want, and I can really focus on what I want. But the publishers that I've had previously, they have been really supportive. It just got to the point where their vision of where things should go and my vision, you know, just kind of drifted apart. I remember that one of my very last books was The Witch's Heart. And some of the feedback I got was, well, we really don't think this chapter is you. And out of the whole book, it was my favorite chapter. And that was just kind of like a little light going on of like, oh, that's, you know, my time is done here. Like, what they want from me and what I want from me are two different things. And it's not bad. It's just we have different expectations. So I need to shift my focus, you know?
And it happens. I mean, and it's you're certainly not the first author to go through that sort of change, and not the last, obviously, in it. And it certainly happens. And we've enjoyed going to the big publishing companies to find out what's out there and stuff, and you know what they have to offer, and that's how a lot of us get started with things. And we want to follow. If you want to follow an author through what they have to do, you know, what else they have. Oftentimes, you wind up with different publishing companies, and it's one of those things that happens. But having that opportunity to work with the big publishing companies to get out there really got your name out there and got you to be really well known, and I think now you have the opportunity to really write what you want, as you want, how you want, and market it, you know, and have more control over the content and the marketing and stuff, which you certainly had to earn that, and I think
definitely.
That's how I see it.
So right now, it looks like you are the main author, the only author.
So,
do you have any plans to have other authors
for
with your company?
Yeah, at the moment, the tough part is that the Copper Cauldrons also owned by the three founders of the temple, and we're so busy running the temple. And that's really our priority, is the community versus the publishing company. Like, if we were really focused on the publishing company, we'd probably be growing it a lot more. But we're really focused on growing the community and running and serving the community a lot more. So we've done some basic things, like someone who's, you know, growing in notoriety in the pagan world, at least in the Northeast, is a woman named Dawn Hunt, who's known as the Kitchen Witch around here. She runs a business called Cucina Aurora, and she makes all these magical food products. And she actually did one of our anthologies. She actually took all the recipes of the temple members to do like a church cookbook kind of equivalent, and she made all the connecting pieces to it and kind of basically wrote the book using those recipes. So she's one of our authors.
It's a really, I have mentioned, it's a very small world. We have her stuff up there.
Awesome.
She's an amazing person, one of my closest friends, really. I love to see good people succeed, and it's great seeing her succeed. So she did our Taste from the Temple book, and then I really was blessed with the opportunity and kind of where my writing project is right now of reconnecting with my first teacher, with Laurie Cabot. Well, not my first teacher, but my first serious teacher, Laurie Cabot. And we were talking, and when her shop was closed, and you know, she's working out of a student shop right now where she teaches, but her own shop closed down, and she kind of put to bed a lot of her spell kits and formulas and incense recipes and things. And so we ended up doing a book of spells and enchantments to kind of record for posterity a lot of what she creates. And that led to a creation of taking her teachings and creating the Cabot Book of Shadows. And we're, you know, slowly but surely working on a memoir for her. And so it's been really exciting to be able to work that closely with her. So she's our kind of other author. We have a little super secret project in the works right now of someone from the early 80s who was involved in the community but not super well known. A book of theirs fell into our possession, and we're in the process of kind of seeing if we can get that ready for publication and kind of preserve a little bit of history, but we're not ready to announce who and what that is yet. But that will be another author, but not, you know, a current author, but somebody who's trying to really preserve that little bit of history. And we might do a few more kind of fundraisers and anthologies where different members of our community contribute articles to it. But at the moment, I'd be hesitant to take on another big author just because I'd want to do their books justice. And if I'm not working the publishing company full time, I feel like I can't promise that they're going to get the attention that they need. So I've actually had a lot of author friends where I've walked them through the process of starting their own publishing company and what we did and who we use for printers and you know, how distribution works and everything, because I want to see them be as successful as they can. And if they can work it 24/7, they might as well keep the profits of it. They don't necessarily need me. You know, I like to be responsible for my own stuff. And part of the freedom is to not feel like I'm responsible for anybody else's stuff.
Right. You're not looking to be the publisher.
Right. You know, there is only so many hours of the day.
Exactly. I mean, maybe somebody in the future of the temple, you know, and from what we've been told by the IRS is that, you know, once I'm no longer a part of it, so whenever I may pass, that I think that the publishing company will then be given, or, you know, through our wills, be given to the temple. And if somebody at the temple really wants to focus on the publishing company and make it like a theosophical publishing company or something like that, you know, where they do multiple authors and multiple books to help support the temple, you know, I welcome them to do that. But I don't feel like at the moment that's my job. And, you know, who knows, maybe later on I'll take a step back from leadership and focus on the publishing, but I think if I take a step back, I'd probably focus more on writing again. So, you know, but who knows? You never know where the future will take you.
Right, right. Just be open to whatever comes over your way, really. Yeah, that's all we can do.
Right.
Okay.
Follow your will.
Exactly. Okay.
Oh, we're already after 10 o'clock.
Yeah, we've already gone. That happens. So we have... We have the flexibility to do this, but we don't. We try not to as much as we can. But it happens. Okay. So is there anything? What else? What else is?
And so you have. You mentioned this very quickly. So you have a book that you do have in the works. No, what is the book that you just? The most recently published book.
As you were talking about
the most recent book is called The Casting of Spells, and it's based on one of my most popular classes. I do a 4-week series on magic and different techniques of magic, and I kind of divorce it, although I'm obviously always teaching it from a witch's perspective. I'm not necessarily teaching it just as a witch's spell casting, but just magic in general, and I talk about a lot of different cultures in it. And one of my students said, you know, this is really great, but there's just so much to go over in the class and you give so much information. It'd be really great to have a book on it, kind of like the way the Temple series kind of evolved. So I've dedicated myself in the next 4 years to do 4 small books on spell casting. So the first one's called The Casting of Spells, and it's just the overview of the theory and the deeper spiritual significance of why magic is spiritually important from my perspective. I get really deeply into writing spells and petition spells, and how to clear your intention and to make sure it's really what you want. We get into magical scripts and alphabets, and then we also talk about some of the kind of traditional spell books and lore, written lore. Particularly, it's all about the written word. So we do everything from the Ephesia Grammata letters to the Hermetica and talking about that. We talk about the barbarous names of power, and we talk about the Maklu texts. And to just quote little things in there just to give kind of historic significance to show that, like, all the way back to ancient Sumeria, the way we've been doing spells then is still the ways we do spells now, you know, from puppets and potions and pins and glass and things, you know, it's all part of the spell casting. And so the subsequent books in the series are going to be one on potions, there's going to be one on candles, and there's going to be one on charms and talismans. And that way, just kind of expanding the non-religious, you know, so many people are just like, I just need a spell. And I'm not somebody who just gives spells to people, but I'm like, well, if you're coming in for a consultation, I'll help you craft the spell for you. But it's, you know, there's standard spells out there, but at the same time, I think it's best when it's really, you know, tailored to what your needs are in the moment and effective for where you're at right now. So I want to kind of get the practicalities and spiritualities of spell casting. I hope each fall.
Okay. That'll be interesting, yeah. So I think we're that'll be interesting series to get into. And then it's sort of like you always see people asking about, like, I want to spell for this, I want to spell for that. It's like, well, here, let's work on how to do it. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
We still see a quite after those.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
People are stuck with the inner and then the most very fast talent.
Oh, wow. I think we're losing your connection there a little bit. You're kind of not too clear. yeah. Huh? Yeah. Can you say that again?
So this is the spell casting techniques of what I've used with tarot clients, you know, and doing consultations, magical consultations with people, kind of outside of the purview of my classes, but it's stuff that I feel has been really effective for people. So I want to pass on how I've been, you know, making potions and making charms and doing candle spells for people and getting them clear intent. And, you know, a big part of my business and a big part of my ministry work has been people come in for readings, and then when the reading doesn't tell them what they want a spell to kind of fix it. So we kind of figure out, you know, where their intentions are and where their true will is and set a spell in motion. But I always have them do something in the spell, so they always have to light the candle, or they always have to throw the incense on the charcoal, or they have to read the spell. You know, I'll set it up for them, but they have to do it.
Cool.
Okay.
Good.
Cool.
Okay. We're wrapping up.
Yeah. you so much for coming on tonight. We've had a great discussion on everything that is going on with you.
Yeah.
And we will.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Keep track of all of your latest endeavors. And for those, David does have the link up for templeofwitchcraft.org.
Yep.
And for your website,
ChristopherPenzak.com.
It's just Christopher Penzak, all one word. You can do a basic Google search and
it comes right up to
your particular website with everything that you offer, all your services and the teaching and everything else that you've got going on. So, again, thank you for being on the show tonight. And I think we might have to do a little bit of shopping here.
I think so.
Well, thank you guys so much. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate the time.
Okay. Cool. Well, thank you. We've been really looking forward to having this conversation and getting an opportunity to connect with you again. So we feel privileged to be able to have this chat. So really appreciate you having the time. And after the long day you had with the prison work that you did, really appreciate your staying caffeinated and focused and whatever it took to have a
conversation. And we know this because we're same time in the same time zone. So we know how that goes. So,
well, thank you.
Again, thank you for being on.
Absolutely, it's been a pleasure. And hopefully we'll connect at a future PSG or somewhere else. That'd be great.
Yeah, that would be awesome. So we'll make sure we keep track of what you're doing and where you're going to be at.
Yeah.
Dance with us, 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 dance of land and sea, chant the rune and it is done, as we will so mould it be.
And thank you for joining us on the Circle Sanctuary Network podcasts, presented by Circle Sanctuary and produced for all who follow the Nature Center paths. Join us here throughout the week for various programming connecting the community around the world. And please don't forget to watch for updates on the Circle Sanctuary website at www.circlesanctuary.org. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/CSNpodcasts. We can also be found on your favorite podcast hosting sites, such as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and others. And until next time, many blessings.